Welcome to the RWE Renewables Q&A call. I will now hand over to Gunilla Greif.
Thank you very much, and good morning again to everybody who has joined us on the phone for this Q&A call with the renewables team. I'm very happy that they have joined us here in Essen. The only one who couldn't be here is Svein Utermoen. However, he's well and healthy. He's just lucky enough to be on holidays. And therefore, I hand over now to Anja, who will make a short introduction, and then we can dive straight into your Q&A.
Thank you very much, Gunhild. Ladies and gentlemen, Anja speaking here on behalf of the RWE Renewables Board. Obviously, we are very happy to meet you for this Q&A session, at least virtually, better than nothing, I would say, in these days. And we are, of course, happy to answer all your questions related to our business. And before we start with a deep dive, let me take the opportunity to briefly introduce my fellow board colleagues, starting with Katja, our COO, Europe APAC for onshore and solar. Katja's focus will be clearly delivering profitable growth projects from her sizable and diversified, and how she would phrase it, unique 5-gigawatt pipeline, which spans the most attractive markets in Europe. And she will be delighted to give you more details about that. Moving over to Sylvia, our COO Americas for onshore and solar. Sylvia for sure will keep on building on the proven track record of the US team with the 24th wind farm just recently COD'd. So congratulations again to you, Sylvia, and the great team. And of course, given her 10 gigawatt pipeline of attractive projects, we can expect much more profitable and attractive projects from her in the years to come. Sven, as our COO offshore, and I speak today on behalf of him, so all the offshore questions, I will try to do my very best to provide you with good answers. Sven obviously will focus on delivering the awarded major offshore projects, like, for example, Triton Knoll. But of course, another focus area for him is to develop new attractive growth options in Europe and then also in APAC for the mid and long term. Moving over to Tom as our chief commercial officer. Tom is also being responsible for partnering, by the way, so he will be delighted to also take all partnering related and asset rotation questions. Tom will ensure that we leverage the best of both worlds in commercial, the capabilities which sit in renewables, and complement these with RWE supplies and trading's global leading trading and market analysis capabilities. Holger, as our CFO, as you would expect from a CFO, he will keep us grounded and he will ensure that we focus on superior value creation. He will also ensure that we apply really strict investment criteria, so there's no escape from his rigor when it comes to financials. And last but not least, clearly myself, as you would also expect, my number one priority is the successful integration of the two businesses on the technical integration side of things, but especially also on the cultural integration side of things. And as you would expect from a CEO, I will ensure that our geographic expansion is disciplined and focuses on the most attractive countries with the aim to realize synergies from regional clusters, but also by applying a cross-technology play. And of course, finally, it's all about operational excellence, so I will also do my utmost to drive the business to the next level of excellence. And this was a brief summary, which hopefully created enough appetite for questions, and I will hand over back to Gunhild.
Thank you, Anja. So then I would suggest we take the first question. Operator, could you please put through the first question?
Yes, sure. And a quick reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you have to press 01 on your telephone keypad. And the first question we've received is from Deepa Venkateswaran of Bernstein. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. So I had two questions. So one is, could you talk a little bit about the U.S. onshore wind market, the key developments given the PTC phase-out and actually extension by a year? What does this mean? Maybe can you also elaborate a little bit about the pipeline? You know, what percentage of the pipeline that you've disclosed today is already PTC grandfathered versus not? And what's your general view that would the PPA prices kind of need to go up, and would corporates so some guidance on how you see U.S. And secondly, I think on Asia, I know in the first call you did talk about that it was not necessarily a short-term priority, but maybe if you could talk a little bit about your time frame for the expansion into Asia and how we should sort of think about it, and to what extent is Asia included in the pipeline numbers that you've disclosed? Maybe it is in one of the charts, but I couldn't quite make out the geographical split, so that would be also helpful to understand the Asia part. Thank you.
Okay, Deepa, thank you very much for the question. This is Silvia speaking. I might take a couple first questions that are related to the U.S. So to your question about the PTC, I mean, we've known for a while that the PTCs were going to phase down starting from 2021. So we have prepared our pipeline, and we've worked diligently to drive our LCOEs down. Also, we see still appetite from the markets to basically contract the output. Also, some states are basically raising their RPS, so their CO2 target. So we see a market that, of course, is not going to see the growth we have seen in the past years, but definitely they will continue being growth, and we see a future for U.S. renewables. To your question about the PTC grandfathering, we've done our homework, of course, and every year we've ensured that we did our PTC qualifying activities to basically give our pipeline the best starting point to whenever we decide to COD, we have sufficient megawatts that would benefit from the PTC level at which we will be at the different COD years. Regarding the extension, well, of course, it's always good news that you have an extra year to basically benefit from the incentives, and we have as well accordingly prepared our pipeline to that. Maybe I would question on PPAs to our Chief Commercial Officer, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Sylvia. So on PPAs in the US, I mean, they are very competitive at the moment and at quite low levels, and therefore we do look at those in the markets where it makes economic sense, because our preference is to have longer-term stable income. However, where they don't look economically attractive, we look at what we call self-structured hedges, which for those who have followed RW for a while are very similar to our implicit fuel hedging approach. Okay, shall I also take the second question on our plans in Asia as well? I mean, I think on that one, our focus is very much on the upcoming offshore auctions in Japan, Taiwan and Korea, where we work with local partners. But obviously, we've also been very successful in Australia with the commissioning of our onshore solar farm.
Is that fine, Deepa?
Yeah, I just wanted to know the pipeline. How much was grandfathered in the U.S. and what part of your overall pipeline is Asia, if anything, other than if it's just offshore wind, that's fine.
Okay, so maybe I take the grandfathering of the U.S. pipeline. So we have secured, with our safe harbor efforts and other methods of qualification, for the solar pipeline, we could qualify up to 1.6 to 2 megawatts, and in wind, roughly 2.5.
Gigawatts,
excuse me. So that's basically what we have done, and we will continue doing, of course.
Okay, and that's kind of on top of the projects that, are already under construction, right?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Katja speaking, taking up your question regarding the APEC pipeline. Besides the one what Tom just mentioned for offshore, when it comes to onshore and solar, As Anja mentioned this morning, we are in construction of a solar plant, a 245 megawatt Limondale project in Australia. Beside these activities, we are carefully analyzing the Australian market, and we also watch Japan and South Korea for onshore and solar activities. But there is nothing what we can at the moment release precisely project. So we are still in the phase of building up the pipeline.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Deepa. Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Wanda Zawinowska of Credit Suisse. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. Two questions from me. The one is on your IR requirements that you show on page 45. Is it nominal? Is it real? Is it post-tax, pre-tax? I would appreciate if you could give a clarification. And one more clarification on the 0.1 billion consolidated annual EBITDA impact. Is it cumulative? So in 2020, 0.1, the next day 0.2, if you could comment on that one. And one more, if I could squeeze on the supply chain.
Just a second. Could you repeat the second question?
Sorry. The 0.1 billion consolidated annual EBITDA impact that you mentioned on page 44, is it cumulative? So in 2020, 0.1 billion, then in 2021, it's 0.2. If you could clarify and if you could explain what exactly it is, I think I missed it during the first session.
Okay.
And the last one on the supply chain, if you could comment on the inflation risk and on the coronavirus, is there anything there that you see as a risk? Thank you very much. And sorry for asking three questions.
It's fine. Thank you.
Okay, this is Holger speaking. So I take the first two, the IRR and the EBITDA development. So IRR, those are post-tax IRR requirements, of course, and inflation is included there. So it's a nominal, in nominal IRR requirement. On the EBITDA figure, on slide 44, it's shown the impact of the divestment strategy, and it's actually a reconciliation between the 2019 and 2022 figures. So the overall impact between 2019 and 2022 is, for that reason, minus 100 million.
So if I can follow up, so basically it's a flat number, so it's 0.1 in 19, 20, 21, and 22, it's not cumulative.
It's not a flat number. It's from 2019. The delta to 2022 is minus 100 million.
Okay, so it could be 20 million in 1 year, another... Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you very much.
But that's the reconciliation between EBITDA 2019 and 2022.
That's super helpful.
Wanda, Anja here. I'm taking the question on supply chain. As I said this morning, obviously we are monitoring the situation very, very carefully and are in close contact with all our suppliers, as we have a very significant construction program underway. I mean, good news so far is that we at the moment do not experience or expect any major delays. Some major components for our projects are already kind of on ships or have been delivered. So the impact so far has been absolute minimal, but of course we have to take this extremely seriously. I think the second half of your supply chain question can you help me again? Was it related to consolidation or what?
It was about the inflation. Do you see any risk to the prices that you need to pay for the equipment in the medium term, I would say?
Well, I would say at the moment the market is clearly a little bit, especially if you look at the turbine supplies, it's a little bit in a turmoil, driven by kind of some OEMs in a way collapsing, with like Senvion and others being, let's say, a little bit under financial pressure. And that led temporarily to a tighter market situation, which drove prices up, but we expect that this will normalize again, also with the more turbine production coming online.
Thank you very much for the answers.
Thank you, Wanda. Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Altun Mamadov of Bloomberg Intelligence. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi there. I have two questions, please. The first one is on repowering. You briefly mentioned Panther Creek in 2019, but when do you expect the repowering to start reaching a meaningful scale? By which year? And the second question is just to clarify on your PPA hedging that you just talked about, Tom. Are you referring to hedging, let's say if it's in the US, it's through Henry Hub, or how else would you hedge as a proxy hedging? Thanks a lot for that.
Thank you, Erin. You mentioned Panther 1 and 2. This was our two repowering projects that we just COD in 2019. Regarding the size of meaningful repowering, there is already going on a lot in the U.S. You surely know that basically we start the clock again to the PTCs. So in order for the repowering to be meaningful, you need to kind of have gone away from the first, let's say, round of PTC to basically make your projects more sustainable. The market will tell. We were quite early in this, and we are proud of that. We just need to monitor the market, but there is still a lot of room for growth in the U.S. for new assets. And regarding repowering Europe, I'll hand over to Katja.
Yes, thank you, Silvia. In Europe, we have some experience with smaller repowering opportunities in some countries, and we continuously monitor the whole portfolio for repowering opportunities, especially in the markets like Germany and Spain. But what needs to be taken into account is repowering, yes, there could be quite some potential, but it always comes down to the restriction which we have to face and the regulation we have to comply with. So it's not that it's fundamentally easier to do repowering than new build. So there are also the same rules which needs to apply, and therefore then the outcome is depending on the situation.
Okay, and taking the PPA question. So obviously hedging with Henry Hub is one option for proxy hedging, but there's lots of different options that we can employ. We won't go through our full hedging strategy, as you can imagine. We can obviously use hub basis. We can also use heat rates. It depends on the market in terms of what's available at a node versus what's available at a hub versus what's available on implicit fuel hedging. So we would use all tools available to get the best risk-adjusted profile.
Okay. And I guess it's like more than 1 or 2 years out, right? We're looking at more than 5+ years, right? Or not really because of the liquidity. How does it look?
No. So for the gas hedging, we can go more than 5 years out.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you, Elchin. Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Rob Pullion of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thank you for doing the follow-up call. So a few questions, if I may. The first one is you very kindly gave us the IRR targets and spreads. Could you maybe talk a little bit about how you expect the spread over WACC to evolve? We've seen a lot of compression for a few reasons. Are we going to continue to see that compression in spread over WACC due to competition, or are we now reaching a plateau? Secondly, and I think very important for our understanding of these IRRs, is what are the merchant power assumptions included in these IRR assumptions for post-PPA, CFD, FIT terms that, you know, frankly, you guys should want us to take into account and to understand the rationale. And finally, the implied gearing of these renewables projects. I was just wondering why you settled on where you are at that as opposed to more or less gearing of those projects. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take that one. So IRR targets, IRR targets, so the actual risk premium, they are derived both from a technology point of view and also a regulatory point of view, and also taking into account the remuneration risk. So that means that in case of a merchant project compared to a fixed income project, returns are expected to be higher and the hurdle rate is adjusted for that additional risk. So that is taken into account. Of course, you can see that only on a project-by-project basis, so taking into account the individual risk of the project. The IRR development, I think competition is in there, so we've seen many, many auctions, but we regard our IRR requirements as competitive. And the implied gearing that was set this morning, the gearing assumption is overall 60 equity, 40 debt. Of course, if we do have a minority position and there is a higher gearing in the project, then we could use project-specific hurdle rates, but the overall assumption for the gearing is 60-40.
That's fine, Rob?
That's very interesting. Maybe just to pull on the threads and not to monopolize the call too much, but just in terms of conceptually, when you think about the merchant power prices you're assuming post these fixed terms, I appreciate it depends on the country, the technology, et cetera, but like conceptually for our understanding and comfort on these IRRs, is that a merit order power price in the 2040s? Is that inflated from today? Could you just help us a little bit on conceptually how you're thinking about it, even if you're not going to give the exact power prices? And secondly, on the gearing, I heard the 60-40. I was wondering why is it 60-40 as opposed to 50-50 or 40-60 or whatever other combination it could be. Thank you.
Well, the 60-40 gearing, I take the first one or the last question. The 60-40 gearing takes into account the overall development over the full project lifetime. So the 60-40 is then, I wouldn't call it an average, but let's say the assumption for the whole project lifetime. What price assumptions, Tom?
Tom, we don't hear you. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I'll take the billion-dollar question on power price assumptions. So I'll repeat what I said before. So our overall focus is to try and get as much stable revenue as possible. So that's kind of the main focus of the business. Obviously, as you mentioned, we do take merchant risk, and particularly in the tail when the fixed revenue goes out. How do we get comfortable with that? I mean, one of the big advantages of being with RWE is we have over 65 commercial and market analysts that basically make sure that we're really robust on our moderate power price forecasts. So we do fundamental modeling, we do risk modeling. We're very conservative and moderate about our expectations.
Okay, thank you. I'll turn it over and maybe cycle back later. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Peter Bisztyga of Bank of America. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi there. So just a question on PTCs, and apologies if this has been answered earlier and I missed it, but can you just remind me how you actually account for those in the P&L? Where do they actually sit in the P&L, and what is the amount of annual income that's kind of in your 2020 to 2022 guidance horizon for those, please? And then, didn't fully hear the answer on your IRRs. You said post-tax nominal, are they levered or unlevered IRRs? So does that IRR reflect already your sort of 60-40 leverage split? That's it. Thank you.
Okay. This is Holger again. So I take the last question first because that's the easier one. So the IRR is calculated on a WACC basis. And then cost of equity and cost of debt, there the overall gearing of 60-40 is applied. So it's a WACC and hence an unlevered project IRR. The PTCs, it's important to mention that on EBITDA level, tax equity is shown as follows. So the production tax credits, the PTCs, are included in EBITDA net of tax. In addition, we can benefit from tax losses, for example, accelerated depreciation. That is shown below the EBITDA level, so it's not included in EBITDA.
Great. Fine, Peter.
Thanks very much. Yeah, that's good. Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks. Next question, please.
The next question is from Sam Arie of UBS. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi. Hello, everybody. Thank you also for doing this call. It's a super helpful, interesting discussion. Just a couple of things. And my first question, sorry, I wanted to come back to this discussion of the current corona situation. And what I hear you saying is, you know, not really feeling any significant impact at the minute. And that's in line with what we've heard from a number of the other companies. But when we get the question and we give that answer, you know, the question comes back, yeah, but how could it evolve? So do you mind just coming back to that topic and just discussing with us a bit what the downside scenario could be? If you've had a look at, you know, what the situation would be if people can't go to work on current projects, how long that might last, whether that is, you know, indicates delays that would be shorter or longer than the kind of contingency you have built into plans. I think, I mean, we do hear your first answer and it's very helpful, but the question that we're getting a lot is what's the downside case? And then the second one, if I can, I'm just really interested to ask you about renewable PPAs in the light of Uniper's new strategy that they put out this week, and in which they've got ambitions to build a significant sort of PPA business, you know, in between the developer and the power customer. And I just wonder if you see that as an interesting market too, and whether you'd be active in sort of independently broking PPAs between other players in the market, even when it's independent of your own asset portfolio. Thank you.
Okay, Anja speaking. I take the first question on Corona. So as you would expect, we have put in place very rigid business continuity measures. And it could go as far as that we split certain teams in half and let 50%, so to say, work from home while the others are in the office, etc., to ensure that if there is, let's say, a case within a team, then not the whole team is, let's say, affected. What clearly also helps us is that we have a global setup. So we have really, and if you look at how our organizational model works, we have a functional model, as explained this morning. So we have, think about, for example, the procurement team. We have teams sitting spread across multiple geographies. So that's, if you would say, another contingency measure, so to say, which makes us more robust when it comes to Corona. So these are very practical measures on top of course, monitoring what's going on the supply chain side, just ensuring that in case our people are affected, that we can still run the business and operate and construct. If you want me to paint, so to say, a doomsday scenario, I mean, if I were to predict the future, I would probably would have had a different job than the job I have at the moment. I think what makes me, in a way, alert but not super nervous is that if you look at the supply chain and the big turbine supplies in particular, they heavily rely on China, and China is already recovering as we speak. So basically, if you look at the factory situation, production situation there, it's almost back to normal. So when it then comes to the new projects, the ones where we take a financial investment decision these days. Obviously, this is at the heart of the discussion with the suppliers, but again, we try to make sure that we fully understand how the supply chain stacks up and where the components come from to give us sufficient comfort that it's under control. But of course, nobody knows exactly what will happen in the future.
maybe I pick up the PPA point. I'll split the answer into two. So on the renewable side, we very much focus on hedging our renewable business. That's our focus. We're about stabilizing our renewable earnings. However, the strategy that Uniper announced, we've been doing that for a long time in our RW supply and trading business. So if you look at page 12 of the CMD presentation, we refer to 5 PPAs. A few of them relate to hedging our own assets, but 3 of them relate to business that RW Supply and Trading has been doing already with external PPAs. So if you like, Uniper may be a bit late to the game.
And that's very interesting. Thank you. And in terms of the margins that you make on those sort of traded PPAs, sort of in the area of a couple of euros a megawatt hour, or how does that
take out? Obviously, I now work the renewables business, so it's not for me to comment on supply and trading business. But the summary is it depends on the risk you're taking.
So no comment. Okay, well, thank you very much anyway, and thank you for the answer on Corona. So it was very helpful.
Thank you, Sam. Could we have the next question, please?
The question is from Martin Tessier of MainFirst. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Yes, hi again. Thanks for all the information that you provide on the project, IRRs, and so on. But could you give us an indication on the spread between equity and project IRRs that you expect? Second question is on the same topic. What is the useful lifetime of a renewables asset that you use to compute your IRRs? And finally, again on the same topic, could you give us an indication of the current O&M costs that you experience on solar and onshore projects? Some of your smaller competitors are talking about 7,000 euros per megawatt of solar, for example. So thank you very much.
So it's Holger first for the IRR question. So the IRRs shown on page 45, or the IRR requirements, are project IRRs. Equity IRRs have to take into account the gearing of the respective project, and that's project individual, so there is no one-size-fits-all rule.
Anya speaking, I take your question. Is it okay?
Yeah.
I'll happy to take your lifetime question, and the answer is it is very project-specific. For each project, we do intensive technical load analysis, talking about the wind side, obviously, to determine turbine by turbine what the useful life of the turbine is, because depending on the size of the project, even within a park, the turbines are exposed to completely different turbulences, et cetera, et cetera. So it's almost a turbine by turbine assessment, which then makes its way into, obviously, the financial model. Clearly, there are a ballpark number is roughly, I think the industry on the wind side is clearly looking at something around 30 years, but it can be more or less, as I said, depending on the project. And on solar is a little bit simpler, because it is a simpler technology and the lifetime is typically longer than wind.
Maybe just to add to that, for accounting purposes, in our accounts, we assume 25 years for depreciation.
Okay, very helpful. Thank you.
And then on the
O&M. Okay, yeah, maybe I take the question on O&M. As Anya said this morning, most of our assets are self-performed, which means that our own teams manage those assets. I'm not going to talk about numbers, but what I can say is that we have seen, of course, an improvement in our performance and also on cost management. So this is our plan for the future, both on wind and solar, to continue doing self-perform in our assets and also for third parties if we partner with other people.
Is that okay, Martin?
Thank you. Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Ingo Becker of Kepler Cheuvreux. Please go ahead. The line is now open.
Yes, hello, good afternoon. Just on your lifespan in information, could you break this down to offshore and onshore, or are you using your average 30 years basically for both? My second question would be on your competitive environment. Apparently, we see a lot of companies having very strict IRR criteria. Do you, I think you said before, you see enough growth opportunities globally to not torpedo that? Is that still the case? And could you talk a little bit about your competition? What kind of competition you are facing? Where are the, you know, different sectors or different type of companies entering your competition in different places on the planet? And just what your experience there so far is. Thank you.
So Ingo, Anja speaking. So again, on the lifetime question, so we depreciate all the assets over 25 years. Clearly for financial modeling, that's a case-by-case decision, depending on the specifics of the project.
Would you generally see a longer or shorter life for on versus offshore plants, or is that hard to say?
As I said, it is very asset specific. It depends very much on the wind conditions and what type of turbulence the project is facing. And therefore, it's a turbine by turbine assessment of loads, etc. And that determines what assumption goes ultimately into the financial model. So you cannot, there's no general rule or something like that.
And Ingo, can you repeat? The last question was on competition. Was it on a specific market or technology you were asking?
Yeah, I guess just generally when you look at your markets globally, do you face different types of competitions, different types of companies, also maybe from different sectors? And how has this changed maybe the last year or two in your eyes?
I would say, I mean, Anja speaking, I mean, clearly with the oil majors, as they entering the renewable space, we have seen a new type of companies competing. If you look at the recent, and their focus has been so far very much the offshore space. It's also fair to say, if you simply look at recent auction rounds, they have not been overly successful. Yeah, I think the established renewables players are taking the lion's share of the CFDs and feed-in tariffs. I haven't seen any material change, so to say, and also on a geographic basis. Of course, they are in certain geographies players. Let's say, look at the U.S., you have a NextEra, which is a super big renewables company among the global leaders in terms of installed capacity, but they're only competing in the U.S. So, of course, you have certain players which have a more regional focus, but then you have the typical suspects which are operating across multiple technologies and multiple markets like ourselves, and you, and we meet each other all the time, so to say.
Is that okay, Ingo? Thank you.
Thank you.
Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Ludo Schumacher of Societe Generale. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, good afternoon. I wonder if you could give us sort of a range for where you see installation cost in terms of euro per kilowatt by technology and across the regions you are active, particularly for offshore wind in Europe. I would like to understand how projects like Cascavi, where I guess you've got a feed-in tariff of maybe 50, 60 euros a megawatt hour, was never disclosed, but it's at a euro above the average, how they can be profitable. I guess it must come down to very low installation costs. That would be very interesting if you provide us an update of the ranges you see.
That's a very good question, but please accept that this is
extremely sensitive, yeah, and that this is absolutely relevant for upcoming auctions, and therefore we would not disclose that. But also, again, I mean, your reference to Kaskasi, rest assured that I'm sitting next to Holger, and he made sure that this is a project which is creating value.
Sorry that we can't be more useful, Luther.
Confirmed.
Okay. Hopefully you understand.
Sorry.
Okay, can we have the next question, please?
The next question is a follow-up question of Deepa Venkateswaran of Bernstein. Your line is now open. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to ask additional questions. So I had one question for Tom and one for Holger. Holger, I was just wondering whether you see any role for project financing, because I know in the past you did include it exclusively, and then in the gross capex to net capex, the difference is all farm down. There isn't really any project financing, which I had thought could be also part of the solution. So one is project financing and that role. And Tom, apologies, I'm just taking the opportunity to ask you a more broader question, given your role and the access to these fantastic analysts analyzing the market. Is what do you see is the impact on sort of power prices from the oil shock, given that the oil-to-gas linkage is now lower? And secondly, do you see a big, I mean, if there were to be a big demand shock, you know, what is the order of magnitude that you might see in? And again, just focusing on continental European power prices. Thank you.
I'll go first with the question on project finance. Overall, again, that is a project-by-project decision, and you are right. We did that in the past, for example, for Tritonol. So the first question is majority or minority. And then there are different types of project finance or financing. So project finance on SPV level, project finance on holdco level, and corporate finance, and that is to be decided for each and every project separately.
Okay, and on the market, gosh, if I could get that right, I probably wouldn't need to work much longer. I think it's very difficult to call at the moment. I was speaking to my overboard colleague Peter, who's even close to this, and he also yesterday said it was hard to call at the moment. I think we need some stability to work out where everything's going. Some general remarks, maybe. I mean, first of all, just to repeat, you know, 70% of our renewable income is fixed anyway, and for 2020 and 2021, we're almost substantially hedged for the merchant part. So from the renewables business, in the short term, a very, very minimum impact at all. Obviously, in the longer term, you have different effects on the oil shock. So in the EU, you would expect gas prices to reduce, which obviously for any merchant power would reduce it. We're seeing a slightly different reaction in the US, where we see maybe some uptick due to the lack of associated gas with the shale gas. So kind of different. And then overall on demand shock, I mean, it used to be the case that power and GDP were quite well correlated. Nowadays with electrification, you don't see it so strongly, but obviously any economic downturn has a negative effect on power prices. But we are predominantly hedged or with fixed revenues in the renewable business.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Deepa. Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Sam Arie of UBS. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Oh, hello. Yeah, just a quick one from me. It's probably a really easy question, and apologies if you already answered it. But regarding that 30% of merchant price exposure, can you just comment on what that looks like in on your current portfolio and pipeline, what that looks like in 5 years? I suppose you've got some contracts rolling off, but then you've got new assets coming on. I wonder if the 30% is broadly stable or if you expect that to move.
Yeah, thanks. It's obviously very difficult to answer because it depends on the ratio of nominal prices and how our portfolio develops. However, it's very stable. So even over the period, if you take our current assets that we've FID'd that are in the current portfolio, which is kind of the easiest benchmark, even over the next 10 years, it only goes from
70% fixed to about 60% fixed. Obviously, there's so many drivers in that that being more accurate is very difficult, but it's a long amount of fixed income.
Oh, that's super interesting. But just to make sure I understood what you said it goes from 70 to 60 on the existing commissioned portfolio. Is that before you factor in the new assets
and the
coming on?
And the ones that we've done FID for.
Right. Okay, so including new build. All right, so 70 to 60 over 10 years. That's a perfect answer.
Correct. I mean, that's obviously dependent on where merchant power prices go because that's the ratio, but very approximately it's a long-term fixed high proportion of income.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because then what you're saying is if the merchant price collapses, actually your proportion of regulated income goes up because you've got less merchant price.
It's a ratio.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I think we all understand.
Yeah.
And 60% sounds good to me. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sam. Could we have the next question, please?
Sure. Just a reminder for those who want to ask a question, please press 0 and 1 on your telephone keypad. And the next question we've received is a follow-up question of Rob Pulliain of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hey, thanks, guys. It actually pretty much just got answered to Sam's question, so I'm good on the merchant exposure. But I'm given on the line. I'll ask a different question, and that is when you talk about the medium longer term opportunity in Asia, and I think you guys super helpfully split out mature versus sort of new markets, which is brilliant. But could you talk a little bit about the risk management for something like Asian offshore, which is clearly part of the long run opportunity for yourselves and peers? You know, how does RWE create the confidence internally and to us externally that you can navigate the enhanced risk and pressures on the supply chain for something like Japanese offshore wind, which of course has not been done before, not by you or by anyone? Thank you.
Rob, Anya here. As you rightly said, every new geography brings uncertainty, and obviously, I tried to explain that going into APEC, we would not do this alone. We would always partner up with a strong local partner to understand, let's say, the local and national specifics, and to, in a way, navigate through the permitting process, not only for the on the technical side, but also then for the grid connection, et cetera. So we would not go alone. That's part of the answer. Clearly, we would reflect also the specific country risk and the specific maybe supply chain challenges, in brackets, which we at the moment we don't see a material difference compared to Europe or the Americas. We would factor that into our return requirements, obviously.
Oh, thank you. And apologies if I missed this earlier, but what you didn't mention there was currency. Is there a way, or would you, yeah, given the very liquid FX markets, is that something you would look to hedge out, as well as obviously, you know, look for a local partner to share the risk?
I would say yes, of course. FX risk is then something which needs to be managed, and whether hedging is then the right tool, yeah, that will be analyzed, but usually this is also associated with the asset risk then, so we take into account what is the actual equity position, hedge of net investment, and maybe currency hedging, yes.
Okay, thank you. I'll hand it over.
Thank you, Rob. Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is a follow-up question of Elchin Mamadov of Bloomberg Intelligence. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi there. It's me again. So given RWE's increased international focus, I had a question on that in terms of renewables. So, I mean, today the situation is that when it comes to auctions outside of Europe, a lot of the times you see European guys competing versus local players. In other words, it's the European companies and developers who are increasingly bidding abroad. Do you see that situation changing, perhaps with the oil majors or maybe some corporations of Japan increasingly expanding their international footprint, or China? Or do you see the status quo of whoever is in their market will stay in their market and European companies will compete internationally? Thank you. And if, as a part of that question, if you can talk a bit more about oil majors, if you're seeing more oil companies coming into the offshore wind market or not. Thank you.
Let me answer the question as follows. I mean, what gives us as a team sleepless nights, yeah, when we think about competitors? I think we believe that in order to be competitive in the current market environment, you need to be able to play at scale in whatever technology you want to compete in. That means a minimum amount of, let's say, megawatts per year in order to create procurement synergies, in order to be able to build up an internal technical engineering and commercial organization that can be leveraged. So honestly, I'm not so afraid of very small players. My focus is on the big international global players in the respective technology segments. There are clearly in certain geographies, and I mentioned, for example, NextEra in the US, there are some local or national players which are very, very sizable, and we take obviously these competitors in their respective markets very, very seriously. You mentioned the oil majors, and I said before, yes, we see them, let's say, being more active and offshore. If you look at, let's say, the recent auction and auction results, I think the majority of the projects went to the well-established global leaders in offshore. So clearly, competitors which need to be monitored, but nothing which gives us at the moment sleepless nights.
That's useful. Thank you.
Thank you, Elchin. Could we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Martin Tessier from MindFirst. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Yes, hi again. Thanks for the follow-up question. This time it's on the cost of debt financing. Obviously, I guess that they differ across all of your projects. But could you give us a range that you observe globally? Are we talking about 1-2%, 2-3, 3-4, 4-5%? Any more color on that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Sorry, we do not disclose any further details on how we derive the renewables WACC. Please understand that.
I think what we can say is that obviously, as it's shown in the CMD presentation, we do adjust for the region and the cost of debt in the specific region. But as sensitive information, we are not going to give more here.
So country risk, of course, is included also in the project IRRs, but details on the cost of debt we will not disclose, sorry.
Hmm. Okay, I've tried. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mike. Try again next time.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Can we have the next question, please?
The next question is from Oscar Nazar of Santander. Please go ahead, your line is now open.
Oscar, are you there?
Yes, now. Yes, sorry. I'm asking, always the last one, I'm missing the answer. On page 42, please, I think it's very interesting, the profile of the EBITDA for the following decade, for the existing and the assets that are going to be commissioned in the next 3 years. The starting point is this 1.4 billion euros number, but should we consider that it decreases in the regulated or let's say these feed-in tariffs or PPAs or whatever between 2025, 2030 should be around 10% of your total EBITDA, so around 300 million euros, more or less, or could you give some indication? Thank you.
Okay, I'll take that one. So I think there are two major assets which fall out of the subsidy scheme in that period, which are two offshore projects in Germany, which is Nordsee Ost and Amrum Bank. So for Nordsee Ost, it starts in the second half of 2022, for Amrum Bank in 2023, and the impact of the transition from the Stauchungsmodell into that floor price scenario is on EBITDA level around about 350 million for these two entities combined.
Okay, and then on top of this, there is any other minor ones on onshore and solar PV?
Minor ones. Yeah. These are the two most important ones, and these two offshore assets in Germany.
Okay.
And it's over time because you have a 2 years transition period when it decreases from 194 over 154 to the floor price level of 39.
Mm. Okay. Very clear. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Oscar. Are there any more questions? I don't think I see any.
At the moment, there are no further questions.
Then I would, and we are almost bang on time with an hour, then I would suggest we wrap it up here. Of course, again, the IR team is there if you have any follow-up questions, and we do hope that once we can go on the road again or see you at conferences, that you then also have the opportunity to meet the whole renewables team in person. Sorry that we couldn't do that today. Thank you for joining, and speak to many of you over the coming days. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance. This call has been concluded. You may disconnect.